Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast. I just startled Lisa.
It's really loud.
I'm sorry. I'm Dave Etler, and I don't know about you guys, Ben Quarchi, Aline Sandook, Casey McCleary, Lisa Weir, and Greg Woods, but things are kind of wearing me down. I'm kind of a little stump at this point. The news has been full of badness lately, and a lot of it has been connected with what I've known all my adult life, but haven't really examined very much until lately, and that is racism in America. So we all know what's going on. I think anybody who's been a med student has been probably paying some attention. On Wednesday, but this all came to a head for me, Wednesday, December 10th, medical students across the country lay down in and outside their medical schools to show solidarity with victims of racial violence in America. And the so-called die-ins are certainly well-meaning gestures. And yesterday, students at the Carver College of Medicine took part in their own demonstration of solidarity. So I thought it was time we talked about this, but I'm concerned about a few things. Number one, this die-in came to my attention on Wednesday, which is kind of late for me to put together a show on this sort of subject. Number two, I'm a white man, and as a resident of Iowa, I'm surrounded by white people with just a sprinkling of brown. It's true that in fact, I was startled to realize that do you guys know this? The 2010 census revealed that Iowans are 91. Revealed. I say that like it was never looked at before. It revealed that Iowans are 91.3% white, 5% Hispanic or Latino, and just 2.9% black, which I didn't realize.
I previous years, actually.
What's that?
It hasn't changed much from previous.
Yeah. It sure hasn't.
Yeah.
And as I look around today, look around me today at our podcasters, I should definitely note that if you were to visit our website and take a look at our pictures, of your hosts today, you'll see that five of us are white and one of us is black. I could have done a better job at assembling a group to talk about race and healthcare. And I should thank Ben, for being here today because he is our student, co-president of the, local chapter of the Student National Medical Association and for agreeing to represent every black person in America.
No pressure.
Really?
Yeah, you're it.
No
I'm
pressure.
The representative?
You're it, man.
Oh, jeez.
I'm kidding. So my fourth concern is that, I think probably like other white liberals have been kind of wondering how and frankly if I can contribute to this conversation. I've also come to believe that the only way I can contribute is by talking about it, even if my viewpoints are inevitably contaminated by my privileges and implicit biases that I may have and not even know about. So with that, I'd like to open it up for discussion. Starting with the die-ins. Did anybody participate yesterday?
I did.
Yeah.
I did too.
So, me too. Sweet.
Okay, so what was the purpose of the die-in? As far as you could tell.
Okay. The idea of the die-in was to essentially show that medical students across the country were dissatisfied with the handlings of, you know, the cases that have been occurring across the nation, essentially.
So you know, we're talking about, of course, Michael Brown in yes. Ferguson. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Eric Garner in New York.
Yes.
And there's plenty of other opportunities to point out things like that.
Yes, there's been a recent case in Oakland where an undercover cop pulled guns on.
Yeah, what was that? Was
protesters?
That was crazy.
Yeah, it was. It's so weird. I saw it last night as well.
Yeah,
it made no sense. And they got arrested for protesting in a nonviolent manner, which is like, what?
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, and I don't think we know everything about that yet. But
yeah.
It's no matter what, it's weird.
It is.
It's weird.
You look like you want to say something.
Oh, well, I was just gonna say breaking news. You heard it here first.
Yeah. Well, what was Aline, Casey, what was your impression of, I mean, was that your impression of what you were doing yesterday?
Yeah, absolutely.
For me, I think that was a big part of what spurred it. These are sort of exemplar cases of a wider systemic problem. And I know for me and a lot of other people, especially white people participating, was the idea was to show solidarity and to show that we recognize that there is a problem. And part of the point, there was actually a really wonderful discussion on Facebook about should people be wearing their white coats for this as a sign of professionalism. And we decided that we should, because there is racial injustice in medicine as well as anxiety on the whole. And we thought that that was something that is so important to acknowledge and so important to sort of start a conversation about. So that was a big part of it for me, was to sort of light solidarity.
Yeah. I think one of the most important things about these processes is that it just should not end there, you know? Mm-hmm. The idea of a dying should not stop at the dying, just participating.
Yeah, where it's like, we've done our part, exactly. Now we can relax.
We want to promote further discussion on these issues, and someone, one of my colleagues, Sheps, actually articulated it really well. He said that the police system have been given the privilege by society to protect society, the same way physicians have been given the privilege by society to heal patients, right? And we both are in this position of privilege, and sometimes we both misuse that privilege, and we need to have discussions about this and how to resolve these issues.
In what way do physicians, do you think, misuse that privilege?
For example, we had a presentation last semester, us in our first year, where we discussed, for example, breast cancer statistics in a Caucasian woman versus minority woman, be it Latinos or African Americans. And what we found out was that the mortality rate for minority groups was significantly higher than for the majority group. And now the question was, why was this the case, right? And some factors included, you know, the poverty was higher in minority groups than in majority groups, and that access to care was significantly less in the minority groups. Now, when we boiled the equation down to if access of care was equal between the groups, we still found this disproportion, which raised the question, if both of them have access to care, and if both of them have, say, you know, the means to get it, why do we still see this disproportion? And we couldn't really find an answer to that.
Other than racism. Yeah, I found some. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it's important to note that none of the racism, most of the racism that we talk about right now, I think, is not conscious. We as a society have figured out it's bad to be racist. We just don't always pick up on what actually counts as racist, and we don't pick up on our implicit biases, and things like maybe being a little slower to treat or diagnose minority patients. So those are the kind of things that, in my impression, are leading to these kind of disparities. It's not like anybody's actively going, that person's black, exactly. I'm not going to treat them.
Exactly.
It's all
it's more of an unconscious or subconscious process.
So if I could break in, I wanted to sort of list some statistics that I was kind of, not surprised that they existed, but surprised at the magnitude. Black infant mortality in the U.S. is 2.5 times higher than white infant mortality. Blacks are less likely to be put on transplant lists to receive aggressive cardiovascular treatment. But they're 2.5 more times more likely to receive bilateral orchiectomy, or surgical castration, if you don't know what that is, and more than 3.5 times more likely to receive lower limb amputations, both of which I gather are due to delayed care. If whites and blacks had equal life expectancies, 83,750 fewer black people would die each year. This is from an article I read in from our friends over at intraining.org, an article that came out the other day. That sort of puts it into perspective, the magnitude of the problem.
It's a problem. How do you approach the problem? That's a difficult question to answer. I'm not really sure Do any of you guys have ideas about how to approach a problem?
You fixed this?
No, I really think, you know, it's hard when you look at these statistics because it's not that we are obviously being like, I'm not treating you because you're black. It really goes, it goes all the way back to before birth. And so many of these disparities start because a lot of health disparities are really due to wealth disparities. And the wealth disparities between races in the United States is incredible. It's mind-boggling, really. You know, when you grow up in a poorer home, you have more health, like, comorbidities, you have less education, and all of that leads to poorer outcomes. So even if you do come in with breast cancer and you have the same access of care and you have the same means at like maybe some point in your life, you still have the previous experiences of growing up that like may reduce your chances of survival and things like that. So, it starts with preschools. It starts with, wealth.
It's a public health matter.
It is
really
definitely
when you put it like
matter.
That, definitely.
Yeah, a couple of years ago at the APHA convention,
American
Public Health Association.
Oh,
their theme was, where your zip code, where you were born, shouldn't matter. It's not just the color of your skin, but your zip code makes a huge difference.
Sure.
There's an excellent paper, I think, out of UCSF where they do look at some of this, neighborhoods where over 30% of the people are poor, just their health outcomes are completely, just almost the opposite of neighborhoods where it's like less than 10% of them are poor. And even within that, there's, racial differences between that. So I think we really need to start earlier and not even necessarily in the health world. Like, yes, we are healthcare providers, but healthcare is probably the smallest portion of health. Like, I think public policy and home and environment make a bigger portion than what we do in the hospital after someone is already sick.
Well, what's interesting about our position is that we are one of the few groups that I feel can truly make steps on this, that especially in that front of healthcare providing and racism that goes on there. Because of our position as med students, moving forward and recognizing this when we do, we are in a very unique position actually to be able to address this on an individual basis. And, that's not as sweeping as it could be because we're just, each one person. But one person starts this whole movement, and I think that's important to realize.
Yeah, here's the thing that I've noticed about, doing things like writing to your congressman is that, whatever you say, whatever you send out to people like this, policymakers, sort of gets reflected back at you or just gets, just try writing to a certain senator from Iowa.
I've done
about,
it, actually.
Yeah. And what you get back is like, well, thanks for your input. Here's where you're wrong. And that gets really, that sort of thing gets really frustrating, because there's no, I've had a few conversations with senators from Iowa over various things, not necessarily, I also wanted to relate a personal anecdote, which I love to bring my own medical history into the show because it's all I have. But,
appreciate it.
I have mentioned before on the show a couple of times, that I was very sick in 1995 and I didn't have health insurance. If you weren't here for the past podcast, I had Guillain-Barré syndrome and, had no insurance. I was a 25-year-old, kid, no money, and, went to the ER and a couple times actually. And before they figured it out. And it was two things I feel about this. Number one is it took 3 visits to the ER to figure out what was wrong with me. But also, every time I brought up the question of health insurance and how the hell I was going to pay for this, they were like, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. Or it'll get taken care of. And the one thing I wonder is, had I been a different color, would that, would that have been a different conversation?
I have an opinion on this.
That could be nothing, right?
So I think one thing that's very characteristic of American culture is that we put a really big emphasis on personal responsibility, but the greatest onus of personal responsibility is on the least fortunate among us. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of people in our country who feel like, well, if we help the poor, then, they won't help themselves. But if we help the rich, if we don't help the rich, then they won't help us back. Do you see what I mean?
Sort of the trickle down as part of the trickle down theory.
Well, I definitely see what you mean.
Yeah, like basically lobbing wealth in different forms at people who already have it, whereas people who have nothing are expected to pull themselves up and find a way to make it happen for themselves.
We do. We put a lot of blame on that. I read an excellent article. Sorry. Did you have something to add?
I was just going to say, sorry about stopping.
No, go for it.
And it's reflected in our healthcare system as well, because people who do have the means don't have to pay the full price. Mm-hmm. Whereas people who don't have insurance actually get to pay the full expense of their medical healthcare bill. And that's pretty interesting.
If they can, otherwise they get ruined, basically. I mean,
yeah. Spend the rest of your life paying off medical bills. Yeah.
Or just declare bankruptcy.
Yeah.
That does happen.
Actually, there's an infographic, I think the most recent that I saw, that medical debt is the biggest single portion of personal debt in the United States, I think.
It's pretty good.
I remember that. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's not the majority of debt, but as a single category, it's like the biggest category.
I got hammered with a $30,000 bill in undergrad for an appendectomy. I remember that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think I got it taken care of, though. Either that or I'm going to have to pay it back sometime.
You just don't know about it.
One of the two, I'm not
What's
sure.
What's another 30 grand, right?
I'm still fighting about $30,000 from this spring that my insurance company is going back and forth on all the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
I think it's also, you know, a good point to note how privileged just the med student population is in general, regardless of your race. I mean, what it costs in a lot of way, shape, and form to get into med school. I mean,
so true.
Undergrad, you have to devote all this time. You probably work less than other people. Most of us did not go to a community college because people who went to community colleges.
I have to interject there that I actually worked 20 hours a week.
Yeah, wow. See, some people did. Yeah, awesome. You know, so some people did, which is amazing. I worked a little and here and there, but you know, people who go to community college are less likely to get into med school. And then there's, you know, there is some help, you know, in terms of AMCAS, MCAT payments, but you know, the just hundreds and thousands of dollars that it costs to apply and go to interviews and stuff like that, you know. So really,
there are barriers to entry to med school.
You know, there are people who overcome it, and it's amazing, but yeah, they're there.
It's pretty interesting to see that, like, in hindsight, looking back now, because, I definitely don't have, in terms of wealth, I don't have wealth behind me to reach this level, but I'm here, which is, I guess, a blessing if you look at it that way.
It's not a blessing. It's because of your talent. It's a marriage of talent and opportunity, I would say, and I think you should give yourself credit for that.
Okay, thank you. That's fair enough.
Just a pat on the back from your average white girl.
That's hilarious. So yeah, I think it's interesting. There's such a barrier to medicine, and yet we're trying to expand medicine. And the argument then becomes, how exactly are we going to do that? Because I see everything as like connected, right? Medical expenses, medicine is 20% of the U.S.'s GDP, which means that U.S. does not get the chance to spend their money on things like new schools, new roads, new whatever. And we see this effect, for example, in Chicago, where 40 CPS schools were closed down because it was too expensive to maintain them. Now that's a lack of access to education, right? So now what the question then becomes, how do we try to reduce the expense of medicine to increase U.S. government expenditure on things that would improve the well-being of other people in society?
There's a good answer to that question.
So I've looked. We've solved it. Perfect.
There's an answer. So a lot of economists have pointed to the like unreasonably large amount of administration that's involved in managing the healthcare system in the U.S. And in this point, and I'm going to say this very carefully because it's the kind of thing that can preclude you from ever getting elected. No, really, tell me.
Nothing. I was saying, oh, are we planning a run? Okay.
No.
Right. Anyway, go ahead.
She's running for community mayor.
Something. No. No, no. That's how rumors get started. Careful. So, a lot of Republicans feel like if you fix our healthcare system, you will kill jobs, which is actually true, because part of the reason that our healthcare system is so expensive is because you have care providers and care payers. And on the one hand, care providers hire huge armies of, you know, medical billers who are trying to get every penny, and then you have huge armies of claims reviewers who are trying to keep every penny. And basically, these people are just on either side of a gigantic rope, and we're throwing money at them to just continue pulling at this rope against each other. And that's, I think, where the bulk of our money goes. It's not technology. It's not you definitely shouldn't pay doctors less, because despite all of the, you know, the nice aspects of living a doctor life, we're still at risk for drug abuse and alcohol abuse. And, you know, rewarding us with the opportunity to take a nice vacation, I think, is important.
Plus, I think the mere expense of medical education.
At least in the United States. Yeah.
Kind of sure.
Other countries pay their doctors less, but they also go to med school
for free.
Free. Yeah.
They still live well.
Yeah.
Those are exactly. Yeah. The other thing to add to your comment is that they live in countries where the cost of living is so reasonable. Because think about the two most expensive things in life. It's healthcare and education. And if you pay high taxes and all of your money goes to that, that also means that everything that goes to your pocket is effectively disposable income, especially if you inherited your home from your parents, which is very typical, I know, in Germany and in a lot of other countries. So,
well, we'll be back in just a second on the Short Coat Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back on the Short Code Podcast.
Okay, so to sort of circle back to our discussion before about you know, racism in medicine and in society at large, there also comes the question of being an ally, because minority groups are just that. They are minorities, and so inevitably you are going to have people from the majority group who want to help and are really good intentioned, and maybe don't always do the best job of that necessarily.
Clumsy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true not just for racial minorities, but for LGBT, for feminists, for everything. So I found online a good blog post from theangryblackwoman.com. I do not know if she is actually angry, but her website says so. If it's on the internet, it must be true. So I just thought I would read these through, and then maybe we could discuss our thoughts on them. Do you all want to discuss after each do and don't, or should I just list them off?
I would say read them all.
Oh, really?
Each?
It's only five.
We're so divided.
Oh, okay, well, I'll do the do's first. How about that? And then we'll come back to the don'ts.
Okay.
Do read links and books referenced in discussions. Even if the things being said make you uncomfortable, part of being a good ally is not looking for someone to provide a 101 class midstream. Do your own heavy lifting. So, educate yourself. Do shut up and listen. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of listening to the people actually living the experience. There's nothing more obnoxious than someone, however well-intentioned, coming into the spaces of a marginalized group and insisting that they absolutely have the solution, even though they've never had the experience. You can certainly make suggestions, but don't be surprised if those ideas aren't well-received because you've got the wrong end of the stick somewhere. Do check your privilege. It's hard and often unpleasant, but it's really necessary. And you're gonna get things wrong because no one is perfect. But part of being an ally is being willing to hear that you're doing it wrong. So it's okay to say, oops, just apologize. Do be willing to stand up to bigots. Even if all you do is tell a friend that the thing they just said about X marginalized group is unacceptable, you're doing some of the actual work of being an ally. And do keep trying. Fighting bigotry is a war, not a battle, and it's generational. So keep your goals realistic, your spirits up, and your heart in the right place. Eventually we'll get it right.
Wow. Mm.
She doesn't sound very angry. She sounds like she has some good points there.
Yeah,
she's very
black
reasonable.
Person.
You know, the one thing that jumped out at me is from that list is the bit about being willing to make mistakes. And I think that is what prevents a guy like me from jumping into something that I have no direct experience with, like, you know, racism, because I'm afraid that I'm going to screw it up. Mm. And so it's good to, you know, sort of bring that out.
Yeah. But like she says, you know, when any new thing you involve yourself in, you're bound to make mistakes, or you're bound to say something unintentional that might be hurtful to someone else, right? And the idea is to learn from that, you know, and the idea is to be willing to put yourself in that position, that vulnerable position, to help, like she said, a marginalized group, right? And that's the whole idea. If you're willing to put yourself in that position, you will be able to further the cause.
Yeah. The thing that stuck out to me was the bit about it being generational. I feel like one of the reasons that I value death is because if people didn't die, their idiot ideas would also never die. And honestly,
that's the person worrying about running for election.
Well, there you go. I warned you guys ahead of time. No, but my point is that change does happen. It just takes an extremely long time. And there's a lot we can do in one lifetime, but it's going to take at least three more generations before. And that might sound very pessimistic, but I think it will happen. But we need to let past generations, like, everyone talks about their racist grandpa that they don't bring their friends around to because they're so embarrassing, and they say stuff like colored folks, and that's really, you know, and I'm sure everyone has that. You know, my grandma has some not conventional ideas, but she's old and it's a little bit late to change her. And as time goes on, you know, every new generation gets better and better educated and advanced in these issues, I think. So that comment really stuck out to me.
Ben,
yeah,
how would you evaluate that set of assertions?
I do agree that, well, you see, there's overt racism and there's covert racism. And the question then becomes, in the newer generations who have tutelage under the older generations, the question then becomes, are they racist also, but don't overtly express their racism? That becomes the real question. And the answer is, I don't know.
You know? I mean, it's almost like we've, you know, if you think that we've made progress, I am pretty sure we have, but we've made progress, but we've probably gotten the low-hanging fruit at this point, you know, like, if you want to look at it that way.
Because, I mean,
there's so much more to unpack as far
it's never gonna be enough, but we can try our hardest and see what we can achieve, and know that with every generation these poisonous ideas that people carry with them get diluted over time.
That's perfectly fine. That's a fair statement. The thing is, what I see numbers wise is almost as if a couple of years back of black society was in a better position, so to speak, than the current state of black society.
How many years is a couple of years? Like 10, 20 years? Presumably not like 100 years,
no,
but I'm just wondering, like, what would you compare it to?
Like the 50s versus now?
I would say so. When black societies had black-owned businesses and traded amongst themselves, I'd say the 50s. I'm not really good.
Like post-war era, basically.
Yeah, essentially when blacks came together as a society, had their own family businesses and their own communities and worked within those communities. But black standard of living was quite better off than what you would say today.
One thing that a lot of people may not know about the history of Iowa is a town called Buxton. And it is a fascinating story, and I've been there, what's left of it, and there's not much left. It's been abandoned for many, many years, you know, half a century or more. But it was a town that started as a mining town in the 1800s, and through the early 1900s was actually the largest black community in the state of Iowa. But what was unique about it is that it had quite a few white people as well, and they worked, and they went to school together, and the school teachers were mixed. Some were black, some were white. It's just such a unique place at that time, not only for Iowa history, but in American history. And there are a lot of stories about it and a lot of interviews with people who, you know, years ago when they were still alive would tell about it. It's a fascinating story. I urge you to look it up because it's very unique.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, the statistics today say that the current state of African Americans is worse than apartheid era in South Africa. Hmm. And apartheid was a legally enforced form of racism.
Yeah. How much of this, yeah, is also due to going back to wealth inequality? I mean, because to really have your own business, you have to have a somewhat significant amount of personal wealth, you know? And so I think that's pushed a lot of like lower incomes and probably preferentially black people, because they tend to have a higher proportion of lower incomes out of, you know, business owning and things like that too. I mean, it's obviously not all of it.
Yeah.
But I think that probably contributes some.
I think in current society there just might be more barriers to entry into any kind of establishment, mm-hmm. yeah. essentially. The current state of affairs is such that to actually begin to set up something that can last long, there has to be a significant amount of investment in place. And you either have that through your family, through people you know, or through loans. Mm-hmm. And there's so many issues with that, you know, with access,
logistics,
kind of things, mm-hmm. you know,
totally,
where minority populations, be it black or Latino, are not given that kind of access as opposed to majority populations. Mm-hmm. And we can go back and forth about why, but these yeah. are just the numbers. Yeah. These are just the facts, you know. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess the next question is, like, I'm always about actionable things.
How
like,
do
what,
we solve
like, what do
it?
You what do next? Do? Because, like, I can sit here and I can talk about it
yeah,
and I can
what
do that,
is
but that doesn't really change anything.
Exactly.
I mean, I guess my own personal is, there's probably not a whole lot I can do to change usually. I mean, I can do my best. I can talk about it.
Don't think
but
that
I'm always,
way. It takes
I guess,
one person
that's
to
true.
Make
and
change.
That is really don't, my, don't you know, think globally, way. Act locally. Like, where do you put your dollars every day? Like, are you supporting companies and local businesses that you really believe
that's
do that kind of
thing.
Stuff?
That's the
you know,
biggest
so I think, I mean, is that something that's going to help? Or are there other things that I can do in my day-to-day life that really will help change this?
I have an opinion about this. I have an opinion about this.
Excellent.
So my sense is that the biggest changes happen when certain views are incompatible with economic success. And the example that I want to cite for that is if you look at a lot of businesses in the South, or actually, let's not say it like that. If you look at a lot of businesses that have come out with their opinions, it really hurt their profit margins. And that was, I think, to me, an indication that you can vote at the polls, but as Americans, we also like to vote with our dollars. And you support businesses that you feel hold views that are in line with your own personal convictions. And I think that sends the strongest message. And is the biggest driver for people to change their behaviors, or at least if they have, you know, counterstream views, that they'll keep it to themselves. And eventually that's how those ideas will die out.
I think that's true to some extent, although it seems like not enough people are sort of informed enough consumers. So you had the incident with like Chick-fil-A supporting anti-gay conversion therapy programs, and nobody knew about that until, I don't know, it happened, it went on for years, and then finally it sort of blew up in their faces, and that's when people started voting with their dollars in that way. But
I think there's a lot of people who also yeah. prioritize entertainment over ethical behaviors. So I think yeah. a lot of people, in spite of knowing what that company supported, continue to patronize them. And
or
that's
low,
also
low prices.
But it's really good chicken.
Yeah.
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 So, I mean, I don't know if that can be the only thing that we rely on, but I agree that it can make a difference. Like, yeah. I haven't shopped at Hobby Lobby since the birth control.
I really believe it sends the biggest message, because money is the thing that Americans value.
Yeah, for better or for worse. That's what we're up against, basically, part of it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely been a change of mine. I mean, just in full disclosure, I grew up in whitest white Iowa possible, probably. I mean,
and
no,
as
really.
I said before, we're already
I mean,
pretty white.
My high school had one black person and I think two Latinos. And I mean, it's a small high school, but still, it's very, very like very white. You know, so I went to college. I grew up
white
on a farm. Yeah. And I, you know, I went to college and it was a very big change. And I think just kind of the things that you learn, you might grew up on a small family farm and I thought everything was perfect. And then you go out and you learn about all these things that happen in the wide world and how people treat other people. And, yeah. So, you know, how I've changed, like voting with my dollars is like, I think is probably the most important thing. My boyfriend and I, we do our best to like patronize local businesses because we love like local restaurants. We do. Mm. And, but at the same time, we're like, oh, you know, maybe, you know, it is easier to go to Panera today. But then, you know, someday I'll want to go to that local restaurant. And if I haven't been going there and they aren't making a profit, mm-hmm. like it's not going to be there for me to go to, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Yeah. And throwing your money at establishments that you know are minority owned. Sorry, mm-hmm. I should have pointed it to you when I said that. Uncool, Aline. But yeah, if you throw your money at establishments that you know, for example, are minority owned or LGBTQ owned, and you know that they've faced additional obstacles on mm-hmm. top of like the baseline obstacles to running a business, then you help bolster, you know, these individuals. So I agree with that. Mm-hmm. There's something else I wanted to point out. I think a lot of people would have much more compassion for these groups if Americans had more opportunities to live and work and study abroad.
I was just going to propose a program where every American has to be, every American at the age of, I don't know what the right age is, maybe 18, has to leave their hometown and go somewhere completely different from it demographically. How about that?
I've been talking about this for years.
That's interesting.
I don't even think you have to go to abroad. I mean, you could send someone like me city Detroit, oh, yeah. and
sure.
that would be
exactly.
That would definitely be a different.
Exactly. Take the converse. Take someone from New York City and send them back to my hometown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's part of why one of the dues of being an ally was to listen, because we haven't all had all of the experiences in the world, and the only way to learn about them, unless you have a really unique experience like that, is to listen to what the people who have had the experiences have to say.
We are approaching the end of our time, but I wanted to give you a chance to go over the don'ts.
Don'ts. These are important. Don't derail a discussion. So even if something makes you personally uncomfortable to discuss X issue, it's not about you or your comfort. It's about the issue. And you're absolutely free to not engage rather than to try to keep other people from continuing their conversation. Don't expect your feelings to be a priority in a discussion about X issue. Oftentimes people get off onto the tone argument because their feelings are hurt by the way a message was delivered. If you stand on someone's foot and they tell you to get off, the correct response is not, "Hey, ask nicely," when you were wrong in the first place. Don't play oppression Olympics. If you're in the middle of a conversation about racism, now is not the time to talk about how hard it is to be a white woman and deal with sexism. Being oppressed in one area does not mean you have no privilege in another area. Terms like intersectionality and kyriarchy, I don't actually know that one, but I guess I need to look it up. K-Y-R-I-A-R-C-H-Y.
Let me know
if anyone knows what
that
means.
Not a clue.
Also, that's derailing. Stop it. Don't pass into a safe space. Don't expect a pass into safe spaces because you call yourself an ally. You're not entitled to access as a result of not being an a-hole. Sometimes it just isn't going to be about you or what you think should happen. Your privilege didn't fall away when you became an ally, and there are intra-community conversations that need to take place away from the gaze of the privileged. And last one, don't treat people like accessories or game tokens. Really, you get no cool points for having a diverse group of friends. Especially when you try to use that as a license to act like an a-hole.
I think we just saw the angry side of the angry black woman.
Yeah. It's okay. I have black friends.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's somehow more racist when you have just one black friend than to have no black friends. Am I right?
Really?
Yeah. It's like
you keep them around as your token.
I've never really thought about these things, but it's kind of interesting.
You know what?
In Iowa, you may only have access to one black friend, so let's not jump to conclusions here.
Good point.
Well, you know what's interesting is I remember a... I'm going to try to put this in a way that doesn't implicate anybody. But I remember several years ago, I guess we were trying to put together photographs. So this comes up often in a place like medical school where they're like, well, this brochure needs more diversity and things like that. And so the people in charge of making the brochure have to go out and find some black folks to put in the brochure. And it's kind of an awkward position to be in, as evidenced by the one person who was being followed around essentially to be the black person on the brochure. And finally they were like, I can't be your token. But you know, this sort of thing comes up, you know, and yeah. You know, people trying not to be a-holes, but at the same time it happens. You
know? I think we should say we appreciate Ben being our token today.
Thank you, Ben.
You're welcome.
How do you feel about that? let's address it. Has this been an awkward experience for you at all?
Well, the thing is, I've never felt like awkward about talking about anything, because I'm always open to talking about stuff. I can see how it can be totally awkward to be a black person in a white group talking about racism.
That's what I was really worried about.
To me, I don't care.
I have to say, it took me hours yesterday to work up the courage to email you guys, and because I just felt like, you know, am I gonna, because it goes back to like that whole, you know, I don't know if I'm gonna screw up here, and finally I was just like, you know what.
And I appreciate that, because I saw it and I was like, yeah, totally, I'll do it. No problem, you know?
And I think that speaks, you know, I think it speaks more that you preface this with, you know, we're doing this and I'm aware of these problems, as opposed to kind of putting your head in the sand, and it's easier to just go with whatever group we have, which in Iowa is predominantly white, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of not even saying anything about it. Mm-hmm. So we might mess up, but you'll learn from it. You made an effort to not mess up.
Well, on that note, I'm going to call it quits. Thank you guys so much for joining me. I really enjoyed our conversation today, and we'll be back probably next week with less important topics. If you like what you've heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Likewise, if we screwed it up, go ahead and let us know about that too. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. Something strange or wonderful happened to you. If you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at theshortcoat.com. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The Short Coat is the show is made possible by this strange world we live in, and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producers are Dave Etler and Jason Lewis. Our opening theme is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.